Hi, this is Chuck Axon with Team Roberts, and thank you for listening to MotoGPOD.
The lights are on red. We're away.
Welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Friday, June 8th, 2007. This is episode 81, and I am your host, Bob Hayes. We've got a really big show today. It's hugely long. We had a conversation with Jules where we wrapped up the Mugello race, and we just had a good time and talked a long time about a Mugello. I actually had to cut out almost half an hour. I put up about 15 minutes of that where we're talking about the qualifying as a sort of an outtake. I'll give you the link later on of where you can get that if you want to listen to that. Then after that, we have a chat with Liam, Liam Schubert, who's our mechanic on the Primac Dantin Ducati satellite team. And we always love talking to Liam. He had some good insight for us, managed to get a little bit of time in his busy week and talk to us about how they fared at Mugello. And we're going to talk to him again next week after the Catalunya race. And then after that, we had a talk with Chuck Axland, manager of the Team KR MotoGP team. And he managed to talk with us for a little while, too. So we got some great stuff today. Not a whole lot of news. It's mostly sort of a wrap-up of Mugello this week. But I think you're going to enjoy the show, even though it is quite a long one. So, real quick, the administrative stuff before we get into this. If you want to send us an email, I am bob@motogpod.com. That's an email to me. If you'd like to send an email to Jules, that's popmonkey, P-O-P, monkey, at motogpod.com. And Liam, you can reach Liam at motoliam@gmail.com is his address. And I'm not sure if Chuck Axland would like me handing you his mail address out. But I'll tell you what, if you have an email that you'd like to send to Chuck, why don't you send it to me and I'll forward it on to him. And we'll find out if it's okay to send out his email address or not. But anything you want to send to Chuck, just put in there, hey, please forward this to Chuck. And we'll send that on to him. And I'm also going to give my obligatory apologies for some of the sound quality. I'm just having so much trouble and I can't figure it out, but I'm working on it and we're making some progress. So a little bit, the conversation I had with Jules, it sounds like I'm talking inside a trash can. The conversations that I had with Liam and Chuck, I do use a cheaper microphone at those because I'm doing that during the day because they're in Europe. So I do that during the day from my office at work and use a cheaper microphone. So it's going to sound a little bit different and that's just to be understood. But the stuff with Jules, I'm going to fix it because it's driving me nuts. Like I said, I sound like I'm a submarine. And before we get into the show, I do want to say a big, giant thank you to Scott Jones for his generous donation to the cause of MotoGPOD. Thank you very much, Scott. That kind of stuff helps pay the bills for Skype and the hosting and all that sort of stuff that we have to pay bills for. So appreciate that a lot. Thank you very much. And why don't we just go ahead and get on with the show instead of babbling on and on. And here we go. Hi, Jules. How you doing?
Hey, Bob. Doing good.
What'd you think of that race there at Mugello?
There was a race? Mugello?
I missed it.
Yeah, which race? We had a lot of great races this weekend.
Yeah. I haven't had a chance to watch the 125s yet, but the out of the 250s and the MotoGP between the two, and so I mean it was a super exciting weekend and probably the best weekend overall so far. You know what I'm saying? Out of the six that we've had so far, I was just like I was really jazzed.
I was too, and not at all surprised because every single year Mugello is one of the best races. I think I wrote an article about that a couple of years ago. Just how there's something about the track, the crowds, or something it generates incredible races. There's never been a boring race there. Even when they have to like stop the race and restart it because it was wet or something like that. Remember that one race in, I think it was 2004.
2004, yeah. The seven lap Grand Prix.
That was, I mean, even that was like unbelievably fun to watch and great stuff. So track never disappoints.
No, exactly, and it certainly didn't this year. So we kind of want to talk about it real quick. We'll kind of
before you get too far. I wanted to say that I will not put up with anybody saying the Mugello track nestled in the beautiful Tuscany countryside again. I can't stand that. Every year I have to hear somebody say that, you know?
Did you catch the Kawasaki press release that I quoted the their cheesy line about it? And unfortunately, I don't have my notes right in front of me, but it was something, you know, along those lines, and it was just, oh my God.
Tuscany countryside, and it's like...
Yes.
Okay, we get it.
In any case, why don't we transport ourselves to the beautiful Tuscan countryside? And
well, it wasn't so beautiful during qualifying.
No, it certainly wasn't. They had quite a bit of rain and nastiness going on. We were lucky that we didn't have too much of that going over to race day. But yes, qualifying the Friday and Saturday were both quite wet. Actually, Saturday was a deluge. And why don't we move on and talk a little bit about the race? We basically, you and I watched it together, Jules, on live. We did a little bit of chatting on the internet while we watched it. Not too much because we were both paying a lot of attention, but it was a barn burner. You know, I was kind of on the edge of my seat again, another race this year. And Jim was teasing me in a call a while ago, Jim Race, and he was saying, you know, this season, like every other season, is going to be the best season ever. But this one to me does seem maybe. It just seems more exciting than last year did. And that might be partially because I had a lot on my mind around this time last year. In fact, as we record this right now, this is a year that since I left to go to Gulfport. So,
oh, wow.
Really? Yeah, yeah. So.
Wow. Well, happy anniversary.
Well, thank you. So, you know, last year, the Magello race was the last race that I got a chance to watch before I had to leave for Gulfport. And I, you know, I did have a lot of stuff on my mind, but these races are great. I mean, every one of these six races so far this year has been, one that, you know, is sticking in my head as being just, wow, you know, what a great race. Even if to a point they are somewhat turning into a little bit of a freight train sort of effect in the second half of the race. It's just like the first half of the race and then the last couple of laps are so great that if there's a little bit of a lull there for, you know, seven laps or so, it doesn't bother me. You know what I'm saying?
I totally agree. I don't find those lull laps all that lull because that's the time you can kind of take a breather and actually watch what these guys are doing and how they do approach the track different ways. Especially in the battle between Rossi and Pedrosa, it was interesting to see how different the lines were for the two. I don't know if it's because the two bikes or the two riders or just I think mainly it's because Rossi just really knows the track really very well. This is why he's so successful at this track is because he's figured out certain things that other riders have not picked up on yet. So that's the time when the camera's not switching around too much and you actually get to see like an entire series of corners and how they enter the corner to get a better drive out of like the third corner in a row because there's a lot of these combination corners at this track. Melandri did an amazing job. Well, let's get to that as we go through the laps.
Right, let's continue on. And actually, though, real quick on that before we do continue on, is that I think shows the difference between how you and I watch a race. That, I mean, you're very analytical and really almost study the races. And I tend to be more emotional of you know, woohoo, some passing, you know. And if there's kind of not that going on, I'll start losing interest a little bit. So
I think probably it's just that I've been watching. You only started watching like in the 990 era, right?
Yeah. I've only been a fan since a few in 2002. Really big fan since like 2003, I guess you'd say. Yeah.
So the thing is that like I think that you know I started watching the GP racing like in the early 90s with Wayne Rainey. And then I kind of lost track of it during the Doohan era, but you know, by the time I got back, I was already like, and I've been to the track many times, and so I actually enjoy watching, seeing the strategies and then like the finer points of what these guys are doing. But believe me, I get emotional too. I mean, my heart's beating. I gotta take Valium every once in a while.
You know, it's just I'm actually real impressed by your ability to, you know, bring up arcane little bits and remember every podium from last year and stuff like that.
I don't know how long it's gonna last as I get older. My memory starts to go. All right, so why don't you do the honors?
Why don't I do the honors of from the start there? Stoner got the whole shot. I mean, he was in the lead right there off the bat, and it looked like it was going to be good. Caparossi got a spectacular start, managed to get up to second. Vermeulen also, you know, did very well. He was right up there in the top three or so on that first lap. You know, there was the usual amount of position changing and all of that sort of thing. We didn't have anybody miraculously go down on that first lap, did we? Thinking about it. Or am I missing some giant obvious...
I was actually looking at the fact that the one guy who did not have a good start was Rossi. He dropped down. And... He ended up being in like seventh place, I believe.
Yeah, he fell all the way down to seventh place at the beginning of that first lap, or at the end of the first lap, excuse me. He didn't get a very good start, which, you know, strangely enough, it is, and he's a little bit like, in some ways, like Matt Mladen. Not that I'd ever want to compare Rossi to Mladen, and I'm so sorry for doing this, but you see him tank the start. Not a lot, not all the time or anything like that, but sort of more than you would expect.
Right.
Yeah, you know, it seems kind of weird, but I think he knows that it's not one of his strongest points is to that ability to get a good start.
Yep.
But what he does have, like Mladen has, to be fair, is the ability to make up for it, you know, and, which, man, if we talk about the 250 race, if we got to talk about making up for a poor start, which was
twice
amazing.
Twice practically.
Yes, exactly. I mean, and we will, folks out there. We're gonna. Jules and I have talked about this, and we kind of try to plan what we're talking about. And I said we got to talk about the 250 race.
So, I one thing I wanted to mention about Mugello, I think that I've never seen a major first corner incident here, even though it's a very, very sharp corner. You're going super fast because it's a long straightaway, and you start about halfway through it. But I think that it's long enough, actually, that the bikes sort of sort themselves out. You go into the first corner, then you've got another straightaway where bikes can start to sort themselves out, and you don't really get into the really tricky sections until about like the fifth or sixth corner, which is probably why you don't see people going off on the first lap,
right.
At other tracks.
Yeah, that's probably true, because turn one, although it's a downhill turn,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, one, the track is wide. It's at least 14 meters wide, which most of the other tracks get down to 13 meters or less.
Yep.
And it also, that turn one, like you say, one, it's a long ways down that front straight, so you've already got a good half a kilometer, probably 600 meters, for them to start, you know, getting into positions and things like that. And then turn one is it's not a huge wide hairpin, but it's a fairly big radiused hairpin. So it's not a super, super tight corner, and it's a nice smooth hairpin.
And you tend to also get into it on the brakes early, and then you're powering out of it. It's a very classic, you know, corner where you're powering up, you're getting on the power fairly early, mm-hmm. which means that you don't get these guys that are braking really, really, really late, especially on the first lap.
Right, which is what causes, you know, these bus stop first corners that you'll see, particularly at the Formula One style tracks that we, you know,
where
it's just, and they'll just come in so, so, so deep on the brakes and then just try and, you know, point and shoot to get around this super sharp bend, and you kind of just don't have that at Mugello. It's a slightly different track.
Like Le Mans, the first chicane after the big, you know, sweeper, it's like, I don't think I've ever seen a race where on the first lap people don't cut through or go off there or have a major crash. It's just impossible. It's tight. You have this quick back and forth after you're going like 150 miles an hour. I mean, it's just, madness, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree.
So nobody went down on the first lap.
No, exactly.
Which is great to see.
Yes, it is always good. And things sorted themselves out pretty well. We had, like I said, Stone, at the end of the first lap, we had Stoner, Caparossi, Vermeulen, Melandri. Barros managed to get up there. He'd made a real good start. And then Pedrosa, Rossi, and Hopkins.
Yep.
And Hayden. Hayden was down there. And what was that, 10th? Is that 10th or is that...
Ninth.
Yeah, that's 10th. 9th.
Oh, sorry.
9th position. So, you know, Hayden actually had a pretty good first lap because he improved his qualifying position quite a bit. But basically from there, all hell broke loose. And I, to a point, I mean, it's just the this was one of the lot of lead changes here. I mean, we had, who did we have? How many different leaders did we have on this track?
On the first lap, well, nothing. But
well, unfortunately I don't have, you know, this guy led for a part of a lap. I've only got the lap analysis that shows the official lap leader.
No, I'm just saying the first lap it looked like Stoner was running away with it, but then he got caught at the end of the straight after completing the first lap. Both Melandri and Caparossi caught up with him, and then, you know, it was no longer going to be, it looked like that prediction of him getting away was not going to happen.
Yeah. That was true. I mean, and they did, they had a tight group there for many laps. I mean, you've seen,
I think it was like 9 guys basically, first to ninth, like where
it was on the way they group it together on the live timing screen, and there's like a bracket around.
That's right.
You know,
that's right. That's
here's
right.
One group,
exactly.
Here's another group. Yeah, and I'm like looking at this. It's like it was 9 or 10 guys,
yep.
And it's like wow, yep. You know, that was in that first group. It was a neat race and very close. I mean, just a wheel between these guys as they're crossing the start finish line and that kind of thing. So.
And we lost the Pugnay on the beginning of the second lap. Which, you know, it's sad to say, but it wasn't a big surprise. He does seem to come down a lot.
Yeah. He's somewhat of a crasher. And and he just... did we even see a replay of that one?
Yes. I don't remember where he fell, but I'm sure if we read Kropotkin's blog, it'll say exactly.
Yeah,
when
exactly.
And
yeah,
how.
I want to talk about a super analysis of a race. It's those Kropotkin blogs, but I don't recall. You know, I guess they probably did, but it doesn't stick in my mind of anything particular why he crashed or what happened or anything like that. He just crashed.
Yeah,
and then
there was some amazing dicing with. Pedrosa and Hoffman. Pedrosa and Hoffman seem to be like every race they're tangling. The only time they didn't get the tangle was in Turkey when Danny got taken out. But it's an interesting little rivalry that I don't think anybody expected. But in the first race, it was like in Qatar. I remember Pedrosa was on the podium. Hoffman was fourth, but they had a really good battle. And same here, they were just like. They got each other's number. Rossi fell down to eighth at one point on the second lap, and then started doing his Rossi slowly, carefully, using the same corners. These are the corners that I was talking about earlier. It's like his line through Casanova, and what's the following corner called? I know Casanova because there was a great comment that. One of the commentators on Eurosport made a few years ago. He was like, well, you know, Rossi's kind of a Casanova, so this is probably his favorite corner to, you know.
The corner after Casanova is called Savelli.
Oh, Savelli, yeah. So those are the two corners where he's good going through.
And that's a classic sort of also a Rossi, you know, it's a right-left. And it's a nice left-handed sweeper. Savelli is, you know, it's a third gear corner, but like which most of the corners on Mugello are, but
yep.
or lower, but it looks like actually this track looks like it'd be so much fun to ride.
And there was that incredible pass that Melandri did on Vermeulen. Was it Vermeulen? or
I know the pass you're looking, you're talking about, and
it was on Stoner, right? God, now I'm forgetting.
Yeah, it was Stoner. And it was he passed him, yeah, on basically on the.
He did this beautiful move where he went on the outside, and anybody who doesn't know the track would have just said, well, that was a dumb move. He went wide. But it was a very carefully planned move where the exit of that corner let him have a perfect drive out of the next corner. This is the kind of planning that you really have to be both situationally aware of the particular track you're at and just really freaking brave.
Yeah. <You know? laughs> Yeah. Now, that was a little bit later on, wasn't it? Or...
I think Melandri by seventh lap was started to fade big time.
Yeah, he was.
It was like in the third or fourth lap that it happened.
Huh. Yeah, no, but it was good, and there was a lot of passing in the first several laps, so it was really hard to keep track. Another thing that happened on fourth lap, in middle of the fourth lap is Curtis Roberts retired. Entered the pits, and I haven't read any news reports of exactly what happened. I don't know if you've seen that yet or not, but we might get an opportunity to find that out. So that's kind of a shame. I came out, you know, on the wild card run on the Team KR motorcycle, and unfortunately had to, you know, call it a day on the fourth lap.
Yeah.
So, but things moved along quite well. We had in the third, fourth, fifth lap, Caparossi was the leader, and he's doing looked real strong up there, and it started almost thinking, well, you know, maybe it's not going to be it will be the all Italian sort of podium that I had kind of predicted, or at least a good start of it, because I'm sure that you got Caparossi, Melandri, and Rossi, and all of these guys are so gung ho at this track to do well, you know.
Yeah,
and so they always call Assen the cathedral of racing and that sort of thing. But if anything, it's Mugello.
Absolutely.
Just, you're in Tuscany for starters. I mean, what more can you ask?
Nestled in the Tuscany countryside.
So continuing on down. with our journey through the Tuscan valleys.
I heard, by the way, that the track is insanely hard to get into because of that Tuscany countryside.
It's like a two-lane road or something for 20 miles or something crazy. Yeah.
and they had, what, 85,000 people?
Yeah.
It's pretty mad.
Oh, I mean, you see the overhead shots, and it's just freaking packed, I can just imagine. I mean, wasn't it that was Mugello last year where they had all kinds of people dying, wasn't it?
On the road to Mugello from heat exhaustion or something, right?
There was, I mean, heat exhaustion, people getting run over. It was incredible. There was like was it Mugello or it was in Spain? And it was like 30 people died. Jesus. I mean, it was a huge number. And on the roads near and around the race, and you know, basically people, race fans, and it's like I can't remember if it was Mugello or not, but I was shocked. I mean, it was like a huge number. It might not have been 30, but it was a lot,
man,
considering that you've got, you know, 80 odd thousand or maybe even 100,000 people actually there, you know, for 15 of them to die in one day or one weekend because of the race is thing. I should look that up and figure out how.
The ultimate fans, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And there was a magazine article about it. But, okay, continuing with this year's race at Mugello, pretty much then, I mean, there was so many cool things kind of going on. What was really sort of noticeable in those middle sections, because I don't have that analytical thing, and although I know I really super enjoyed the race, I'm not thinking of...
Well, we had some very good dicing between... you know, Rossi and whoever he was his next target. He was doing very, very calculated. You know, he knew he had lots of time to get up front. He has done a mistake before of trying to get to the front too early and then eating up his tires. So I think he was probably just being extra careful. He knows this track very well. And of course it was dry, which he's very comfortable with.
Right.
The big surprise from the whole weekend and then also by the sixth lap was that Pedrosa got up there. Pedrosa was leading by the sixth lap. He took the lead from Stoner. Caparossi ran really wide, and this is the kind of thing you I've seen at Mugello before. It's like, if you make a mistake at Mugello, it's a very costly mistake. He didn't lose that much time, but he lost like five positions. He went from leading the race to being like sixth. You know.
Yeah, that's one thing I wrote down here. When I watch the races, I'll write down little notes, and that's exactly what I wrote. Caparossi loses five positions first to six, and yep. Pedrosa takes the lead.
Yep, yep.
And then lap five.
And you know, I we don't talk about too much about this, but I sense that there is a very, very intense rivalry between Stoner and Pedrosa still left over from the 250 days. And, mm-hmm. you know, last year there were the two rookies that were everybody was looking at. And, I mean, they weren't the only rookies, but they were the two, you know, highest profile rookies.
Yeah, they
were high profile. So I know that every time those guys are close to each other on the track, it's a big deal. You know, but just got the better of Stoner, got past him, and was looking pretty good until Rossi came through, went past Stoner, at which point my wife yelled out in delight because she's been very frustrated with the season so far.
Oh, really?
She's a huge Rossi fan. It's ridiculous what a Rossi fan she is.
And that actually happened on lap 9. Rossi's credited with finishing lap 9 in the lead.
Right.
Around lap, it was actually lap 7, did you see the shot of Pedrosa coming? And I think he was coming onto the front straight. And his front was just all over the place.
Yes, yes, yes. But actually, both him and Stoner, when they went onto that straight, had the same kind of thing happen to them. I've actually had that happen to me on the track before, and you don't really think about it, but
no.
You really like, you know, the tolerance there is. I mean, you're just moments from low siding or something nasty happening at that point.
Right.
These guys just, you know, you have the only thing you can do really is let the bike ride itself up. It's like you let go of the handlebars.
You don't let it sort itself out. But you know that head shake like that can be unnerving, and you know, it's definitely a little bit of a surprise.
Well, I think it happens a lot more than we see it, and that happened to be a really good shot too of
that might
through.
Be it, because it was. I mean, Pedrosa's coming straight at you at that point, and you just saw the front wheel was just flopping all over the place. It wasn't quite a tank slapper, but it was
getting there. It was getting there. There's a lot of power on these things, you know.
Oh yeah, yeah, insane amounts of power. So moving on up, basically once Rossi took the lead, it was pretty much the Rossi show at that point.
Yeah, Pedrosa stayed with him for a little while. I think he stayed with him to about lap 16 or so. Right. This is the something that I think I'm a little bit disappointed with Pedrosa, is that this has happened to me. We actually had a really good fight between Pedrosa and Rossi. We've been waiting for this for 2 years now. This is the first time where we saw a lot of passing between them. I mean, Rossi is on the is listed as a leader on those laps, but he wasn't leading every corner.
No,
there was a lot of dicing.
Exactly. There were times when Pedrosa would get past him or at least show him a wheel and things like that.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. But the thing is, like, when Gibernau and Rossi were racing, they did that to the very end. And I've not seen Pedrosa do that kind of thing to the end. I think maybe there is still some truth to the fact that his size, strength, whatever, does pay a little bit of it does hurt him a little bit. I think he gets tired.
This is a stamina thing. Yeah, that's a possibility.
Because
I was wondering if he's just burning up his tires and that it's more of an almost an experience thing.
Maybe about every race. I mean, it's a pattern. Even the races that he wins because he's way ahead. But he can afford to ride a little slower. So Rossi by lap 14 started to take off, and it was, unless he was going to make a mistake, it was going to be the win.
Right. He was up in the leading by a second sort of a range by that point. End of lap 16, it was 7/10. Lap 17 was 9/10. That kind of thing. He took off and it became, he was clearly going to win it. It was his to lose, basically.
Exactly, like exactly. And then, and Pedrosa, there was a big gap from him to Stoner, so he had a good solid second. Mm-hmm. And so now...
And again...
Go ahead.
Again, Pedrosa riding his own little mini race. I mean, he's been doing that a lot, too. He might, in this case, it was at second. It's been at fourth. It was fourth in at Le Mans. And he's just by himself. He's got 2 or 3 seconds on either side, ahead of him and behind him. And it seems to happen to him a lot.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's because he may not have the stamina to keep the fight up with the guy in front, but he's definitely got the skills to. He doesn't need to have a carrot or somebody chasing him to ride fast, which is a great skill to have,
Yeah, sure. Yes, it is. And I mean, that's actually one of the tough ones to master for a lot of these guys, top-notch riders. But when they're in front or sort of just by themselves and they can't kind of see the traffic, they, will lose focus one way or the other.
Yep.
Schwantz had a terrible problem with it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I think he was always looking for Rainey specifically.
Yeah.
Where's Rainey? I can't ride this track.
Yeah, exactly.
And then, so for us, of course, then the big race became, Barros coming up. He was fifth and fifth and fifth, and he finally got past Hopper on, what lap was that? Probably like lap 16 or 17 or 18, somewhere around there. He got past Hopper, and, he had a couple of very good laps, and suddenly he was on Stoner, and that's when I was like on IRC going just Barros. Basically
screaming at each other with typing. It was kind of slick, and that actually happened officially according to the lap count on lap 21.
He got past them, they're both pretty much in the same machine, although as Liam will tell you, the parts do come in a certain order. But they're pretty much the same bikes, which means that Stoner did not have the benefit of being able to pull away from Barros on the straightaway, and Barros is extremely good on the brakes, so he's very hard at the end of that straight, and that's what I think where he got enough of a lead where he actually must have made a mistake because he had two or three tenths of an advantage on Stoner by the end. It was a race to the finish line, and you remember there was a guy like a fan walking across a photographer or something.
Wall. You couldn't see because this guy was looking over the wall.
He blocked our view
right
of Stoner, and we're like, "Come
like
on, get out of the way!"
Yeah, exactly. Couldn't see anything.
But then Barros, the reason why we're cheering for Barros is, for two reasons. One is Barros is a old-timer. It's good to see him, kick butt. Actually, three reasons for me, because also just the fact that, on the Ducati track, the satellite Ducati team beats both the Ducati machines, the factory machines. And, of course, the biggest reason is that we got to see Liam celebrating at Parc Fermé at the end.
Wasn't that cool? I mean,
amazing. Amazing.
Clapping and smiling and everything. I'll bet he's had a great time. I sent him an email. I still haven't heard back from him. So he's
probably passed out.
Nursing the hangovers and all of that. Yeah. But no, I'll bet it was, just crazy celebration going on in the Dantin pits. I mean, and that's great. And we knew they would podium. We said they were going to be able to. So now, you know, the next goal is a second or a win. And yep. They might be able to do it.
Yep.
When you mentioned a minute ago, the Stoner, you know, being able to power away, and that he couldn't quite do that on Barros because, you know, they're both riding the Ducatis. I think that at this track, considering that long front straight, you've got an 1,100 meter odd front straight, and I think that the bits that were the performance that they squeezed out of many of these machines that Julian Ryder was writing about before the race and that I mentioned on the last show, I think that came through because it didn't seem to be quite such a night and day. A difference.
Totally, where, totally. Know, there were only about two or three moments where there was an obvious underpower pass. You're totally right. There was there was a lot more equality in terms of that straight. Also, I think Stoner doesn't get that track. He seemed to have trouble getting onto that front straight, and it's so important to get that because it's not really a straight. There's a little bit of a kink in it. And you have to get it quite right, and it's up and down and. There's this weird place where you kind of have to lean a little bit to the left to make it through. You know, it's not a true straight, and so you got to get the drive right.
Yeah, it's more of a classic track. It really is with not quite like a road race. You know, where it's all these country lanes kind of a thing, but.
Right.
It's definitely not a Herman Tilke designed cookie cutter, Shanghai or Malaysia or
whatever
track. Yeah. And not that those are always bad, but they're just usually bad.
That's right. All right. So let's go through the final standings. One thing I wanted to mention is that, I'm starting to feel extremely bad for Nicky Hayden because there was a comment that Nick Harris made where I was just like floored. Where he said something like Nicky Hayden is riding what did he say? He said a commendable 10th place, and I'm like a commendable 10th place for. The world's champion, and I'm not being like flippant. I mean, Nicky Hayden is not a 10th place rider. You know, he's still struggling. This guy is still struggling, and I really wish that he figures out what the hell is going on because I just hate seeing it. I hate seeing it like
I
this.
Agree. It is almost sad to see, and he's not getting the coverage and. All sorts of things. And Nick Harris is a huge Hayden fan.
I know.
I mean, he's always, you know, have you ever noticed how much Nick Harris, you watch the 250 race and it's like, it's the freaking Anthony Davis show. And it's like, you know, this guy is in 15th place, but, Hayden's or, Nick Harris is going on about, and Anthony Davis came in such and such a place.
Right.
It's like, dude, you know, I mean, we've got, other people.
Are you talking about Ant West?
And, he's almost that way about Hayden. He's very, buoyant, he likes him, and because Hayden's an honestly likable guy.
Yeah.
And these announcers interview these people and everything, and they get to know them and all of that. And yeah, you're right for that comment. I do remember that comment, and it was I can't remember the exact words, but I think it was something like that. And
it kind of burned me because I wanted to say, you know, I mean. I don't know. I know that Nicky is not thinking that. I think that Nicky is sitting there going, "God damn it!
Yeah,
I got to. Right. What is going on? You know, I got to get something out. I got to figure this thing out. And especially now that Pedrosa's doing
Harris
better.
Harris didn't mean in a snarky way. You know, he's like, but it's a little bit like, you know, yeah, a left-handed compliment, I guess
you
call it.
There you go. There you go.
So yeah. Let's go down the classification. Like we said, Valentino Rossi took that lead mid-race and never let it go and ended up finishing the race 3 seconds ahead of Pedrosa. He came across the finish line, we were riding a wheelie and everything, and I mean, you could just hear the crowd just freaking out, you know, that Rossi won his sixth Mugello in a row. And it was an impressive performance, and wasn't one that was either, it wasn't, you know, a done deal going into the race either. You know,
absolutely
there was a lot
not.
Of doubt.
Absolutely not. I mean, before Le Mans, we were talking, Le Mans is the last chance before, like, we get to Sachsenring where Rossi will be able to beat Stoner, right?
Mm-hmm. That's
and
true.
Le Mans, right. Yeah, Le Mans was where, because you got Catalunya as a fast track, Assen's a good Ducati track, and there he is, you know, like, he didn't do so well at Le Mans, and he made up for it, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it was skill and cunning a lot more than the bike, although I think the bike has gotten a lot better.
Yeah, they're doing improvements, but no, this was, I mean, Rossi just, I mean, he was probably just exhausted after the race because he put everything into it.
Yep.
And he had the big heart on his helmet, like, you know, he's putting his heart into it and wearing his heart on his sleeve and all that kind of thing. And I think that really summed it up.
Yeah, and I love the fact that he tossed it into the stance for the
podium.
Yeah,
I know. Yeah, that shot, the shot of him tossing it. You know, I mean, you see riders throw their helmets or something out in the crowd all the time, but yeah, he heaved that puppy, and I'm just thinking, Christ, you know, getting bounced on the head by a fucking 7-pound Suomi helmet. And also, and you pointed out the riot that must have been going
on
for that thing.
Oh my
too.
God. Oh my God.
Man,
that would
be
crazy.
In the middle of that. Yeah. Wouldn't mind having the helmet, but I don't want to have to, you know, have somebody gouging my eyes out to try to get it from me. But okay, second place, Danny Pedrosa, again. You know, and this is a track that he's never did all that well on the 250s. He finished, what, fourth last year, which was pretty good, you mm-hmm. know, considering that he hates the track and so that sort of thing, hasn't done all that well here. I don't know if he necessarily hates it, but it's never been his strong point of a track, you know. And I think he did great. He did fantastic. That's the best finish by a Honda thus far this year. And
yeah.
I'm looking at my thing. Actually, Melandri had a second at France, which I should have remembered. But
yeah,
you know,
well,
still,
you know, I wet races. I don't really.
That's true. That's true. It's a different. Yeah, exactly.
It's a different.
But
kind of
in any event, you know, it's where we expect to see the Hondas, and seeing the Hondas, you know, so much farther down the grid is a little bit of a you know, wow, it's bizarro world kind
yep.
of a thing. You know?
Yep.
Third place, rounding out the podium, Alex Barros. And like mm-hmm. you said, that was really, really cool. I mean, we see, you know, poor old Barros that, you know, people would have said he was washed up last year.
Yep.
He's gone.
Yeah. Well,
and
he was gone.
And, you know, now he's back. And he is riding for, you know, one of the lesser teams on the grid, you know, the satellite, the Dantin team. They're not the mega high dollar, you know, they're not the what was it, the term we used once, the Minardi of MotoGP or whatever the hind tit Formula One team is now, but they are, you know, but they're not the in the clouds either, you know, they're a mid-level team.
Yep.
and you know, for him to win for him to get a third on the podium in just a few races and everything is really, really cool, and it's a good thing. So, and like you said, ahead of his factory what do you call them? Rivals, I guess.
Yeah,
factory rivals. Yeah, they are rivals. They're not teammates. Fourth spot, one of those factory rivals, Casey Stoner.
Still championship leader, but man, he lost 12 points on this one.
Yeah, lost a lot of ground. But like you say, he is still the leader. He's still doing real well. This puts him at an average that kind of struck me funny of what his average point score was last when I figured it out last time. So I was looking at that again. Mm-hmm. He's got 115 points over six races. So he's dropped below 20 points a race. It's, you know, only about 19 points a race. Only we say.
That's amazing.
But,
amazing.
Yeah. So he's still doing really well. I mean, the guy's got, you know, three wins this year, and his worst position is, fifth.
The fifth, yeah.
You know, I mean, he's just cooking. So, yeah. Speaking of fifth place, though, John Hopkins on the Suzuki. And it's good to see him up. At least, you know, he's finishing top five, top six. You know, these kind of numbers. You know, he had his podium this year, his first podium in his whole MotoGP career, which is a long one. And he was speaking when we talked earlier about the 990s and the two-stroke era. Hopper started on the Red Bull team back in 2000. One, or
he was in 2002, but it was the last. He was still riding a two-stroke.
Yeah, and you know, he's been in MotoGP a long time. And
he's a young kid. I mean, he started when he was 17.
Yeah, exactly. That's part of the thing. It might be, you know, some might say that it's part of the problem or not. I don't think so. I don't think there really is that much of a problem anymore. I think that he has worked with Suzuki and things, and he's really growing, and the whole team is sort of developing and this and that for a variety of reasons. And I think I think we'll see him on the podium again. And who knows? We might even see him win one if the conditions are just right. You never know. Speaking of Suzuki's, real quick, I want to throw this in there. I was talking to somebody, a friend of mine, a real life friend, not an internet friend, and and I.
What am I, Bob? What am I?
What? No, no, you're a real life friend too, Jules. But I am talking to you on the internet right now. But I said something about the Suzukis, and that, you know, and he says, yeah, they're doing great. And he just throws this out there, and I hadn't even considered it at all. He says, it's because they, you know, they've always done so well with the GSXR 750 and AMA and everything. And I was like, you know, thinking, I wonder if he has a point there. And I do. Basically, I wonder if this, does that make any sense that they could translate their experience and fantastically successful track record with the 750s to making an 800cc prototype motorcycle.
It's a very interesting theory. I mean, these bikes are so different that I would be a little bit hesitant to say that, it's different engine configurations. There's different suspension, chassis. Everything's so different that it's hard to say. But maybe there's something to it. Maybe there's something to it.
I thought it was super interesting because I hadn't even considered it. And I did, you know, I thought when we said that, just like you're saying, you know, it's apples and oranges. But I thought there might be something to it. So maybe, you know, if you fans out there, you have an opinion one way or the other, we always like to hear this kind of stuff and get into these sort of email, you know, chit-chats, and might show up in a later show. So send us an email, motogpod@motogpod.com, about what you think about that one. And real quick, we're going to run down the rest of the race classification because we're way over time. Sixth spot went to Tony Elias.
Which is a great finish considering where he started.
Exactly, it is. I thought it was great. Seventh, Loris Caparossi.
Which is a terrible position for this track for Loris. I mean, come on. This is a track he always does very well on.
Right. And last year he was on the podium, and this year he didn't do so well. And it's kind of sad, but not sure what happened there. He just didn't run a very good race, basically what happened.
Yeah.
For a lot of reasons. Eighth spot, Chris Vermeulen on the Suzuki, and I think it was somewhat to be expected. He's, it's a commendable finish, to use that term again, a very commendable eighth. But somewhat disappointing if you compare it to his qualifying, but the qualifying was wet and the race was dry.
Right, right. It was actually one of his better dry finishes this year.
Right, yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, it's not a bad finish. It's more than the top 50%, right?
Yep.
Ninth spot, Marco Melandri.
Big disappointment. Big disappointment.
Exactly. Marco. That's his worst finish all year. Especially considering, again, like I said, you know, my hopes and dreams for the all-Italian podium are shattered. But, you know, because he was way, way down there. And I was thinking he was going to be pulling in a third. So, and speaking of shattered, 10th spot, Nicky Hayden. So,
ouch.
Didn't do too well there.
Ouch.
Yes, ouch, big time ouch. I mean, he picked up three spots from his qualifying position. So, I mean, I guess looking on the bright side there, you know.
Yeah, but three. It could have. Yeah, I guess so.
Three riders retired, yeah. Yeah. But they were all behind him.
Yeah, so, yeah, they were.
Depunier wasn't. But, yeah.
Actually, no, Depunier was in front.
Yeah, Depunier was in front of Hayden, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Depunier is getting a lot of, like, I was in front of this guy's, you know, this year, to
right,
put in his little scrapbook.
Right.
I mean, he's passed
for
Rossi
two laps.
Times. So, yeah. I mean, although he didn't finish this one, at least, you know, he gritted in front of Hayden.
Yeah.
11th spot, Alex Hoffman on the other Dantin Ducati. So, not too bad. Who finished in front of Colin Edwards, who had a... not very commendable 12th. You know, let's face facts. That's a sucky performance.
This is the thing that the reason why Rossi put the heart on his helmet is because there's been so many people saying that he's kind of lost heart, lost his passion for the for racing, and that he's just doing it as a job, which I think is such total bull.
Total crap. Yeah.
This is the kind of measurement you look at this. You say, okay, the Rossi wins the race on a Yamaha, which is pretty much the same bike that Colin Edwards is. And Colin Edwards is no slouch. Look where he finishes.
Right.
You know?
Exactly.
I mean,
you know, even if you sort of take out the factor that Rossi loves this track and Edwards hates it and this and that and the other, still first to 12th. Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. I see what you're saying. Yeah. And 13th spot, Shinya Nakano, which actually, yeah, not too bad for...
you got some points.
Considering. Yeah, some points, exactly, yeah. 14th, Sylvain Guintoli on the Tech 3, talking about some points, which is kind of nice for him. It puts him in a 16th in the championship. 15th spot, last guy in the points, Makoto Tomata. And then 16th, Olivier Jacques. Disappointing race down there for Kawasaki. There's a lot of issues.
He was apparently in a lot of pain. It was a pretty brave finish, gotta say.
Yeah, I bet it was. I know he was, because that injury was no small matter that he had.
He had an infection there, I believe, right?
Right. He did have some kind of infection going on. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
and
that's nasty.
There was some doubt that he was even going to make this race. It was, you know, he was hoping to come back for Le Mans, which, you know, of course, you know, being French and all that, you know, his home race and stuff, and then that didn't happen, and it wasn't even a done deal that he was coming back for this race.
Yeah.
So yeah, another, you know, the classic, you know, professional motorcycle rider that goes out there and rides in pain, you know. And then 17th spot, last on the thing, lapped, what, once or twice, Kenny Roberts Jr.
Yeah. Did he actually go into the pits at some point?
Let me check. He's not marked on the thing, no, as entering pits. So,
man, you're right.
Because they always put it on there, and it's not on there.
So. Yeah, it's terrible. That's just terrible.
I know. Yeah, it sucks. So, again, you know, we're just... I know they can do better. They will get it together and figure out that something to at least...
Maybe
at least
Estoril.
Yeah, something. And we were talking, because it was last year, it was roughly around this time in the season that Honda gave them quite a bit of serious help.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, they started improving. And... So, you know, and we were hoping that something along those lines would happen. So, you know, again, there's always Catalunya. Maybe something between now and then. That's only a week. And then after Catalunya, we have, is it Assen?
Assen, yep.
Assen, yeah. And so, you know, who knows? Whatever. They'll figure it out. Not classified
Assen
this
is,
race.
I'm sorry. Probably. After Catalunya, we have Donington. And then
Donington.
Assen.
And yeah. Okay, yeah. Right, and they changed the order a little bit from last year,
yep.
And or changed the dates as much as anything. All right, and actually, yeah, Donington's one of my favorites. Carlos Checa did not finish, not classified. Like we said, he crashed out fairly late in the race. And Curtis Roberts retired lap 4, and Randy Dupuis crashed out on the second lap. So, you know. It's not too bad. Three guys, especially considering that the weekend started off wet and the race might
been,
be wet and all of that.
Bad.
You know?
Been bad.
Yeah. Wasn't the bloodbath that Le Mans was. So we got to talk about the 250 race because we said we were gonna.
We can just talk about that one lap if you want.
the fact. Okay, remember we talked earlier on when we were talking about the qualifying for MotoGP that Tomata did not. Officially did not qualify because he was over 107% of the time of the pole sitter. And according to the FIM rules, that means you suck and you're not allowed to race. But
right.
They'll make exceptions. And actually in MotoGP, they always make an exception. The last several times that I can remember, when we had the guys on the WCMs that were getting outside the 7%, somehow or another race direction would find a way to let him race because they didn't want the grid to be 4 rows deep. And this one, it makes sense. And I'm not trying to be overly mean to Tomata or to Lorenzo, but, you know, these guys had shitty qualifying sessions because it was wet and this and that and the other, so they let them race.
It wasn't just that it was wet, because it was wet.
I mean,
it was a change in conditions, you know? It's like you basically
right,
you drew the wrong hand when you came out and just happened to start raining when you were on dry. tires exactly. or something. So
I think it's, you know, and it does. It makes things difficult. And you could say, well, you know, that separates the men from the boys as far as a team is concerned, you know, or not, you know. But in any event, what we're talking about here with the 250s is Jorge Lorenzo, one of the fastest guys by far on the 250s this year, and the world champion from last year, did not qualify. He started 20th on the grid on the 250s, and by the end of the first lap, he was in 8th.
Yeah.
And I mean, that was, and it was something to watch. I mean, the start alone was like, my God, you know,
Have
you ever seen, the military aircraft where they start with the rockets and they just,
the JTOs. Yeah.
It was, JTO. Exactly. It was like that. And, it was just like, he just, man, powering past these guys. And he just, he did a very Rossi-esque progression up the order of, you know, he was 8th at the end of the first lap and, you know, I don't know exactly. I don't have the lap chart in front of me, but, you know, 7th from the second lap, whatever it was. And he just dunk, and moved right on up to lead the race.
He was leading the race about halfway through. No. He took
over. Two-thirds of the way.
Yeah, Barber made that big mistake, and that's when he got ahead.
Yeah, and I mean, unfortunately, on that one, I did not watch the race live, because for me, it started at, you know, like 4 o'clock in the morning. So I watched it on the MotoGP website, but later in the day, and you cannot avoid seeing who wins the damn race. You know, I mean, unless
I'll tell you the trick. There's a trick to doing it.
Oh, I covered it with my hands. All kinds of stuff. What's your trick?
It's how slowly you open the window. Anyway, I'll show you how to do it sometime. Anyway,
all right, you'll have to show me.
But Barbara made this. Barbara was really looking good at this race.
Yes, he was.
Terrible mistake in lap 12, and then he dropped off like into 5th or 6th. Quickly, let me look at this. Yeah, and he dropped off into 5th, gifted Lorenzo the lead, and then we had, you know, Bautista and De Angelis, who are teammates, had this really weird exchange where they were like,
the hand gesturing.
Yeah. It looked like maybe De Angelis was pissed at Bautista, but then
looked like a finger shaking, you know.
But then it was like more of like a come on, let's do this, you know, let's
yeah, get that's what they,
one
Matthew
more time.
Was saying. I think, you know? It looked like, you know, get the hell out of my way.
Yeah.
But it might have been a come on, let's do this, I suppose. But yeah. But by and large, the 250s this year has been the
Lorenzo show?
The Jorge Lorenzo, Andrea Dovizioso, Alex De Angelis show.
Right.
Those three guys from three different teams have been finishing consistently in the top three, or at least, you know, maybe the podium wasn't like that, but most of the race was.
Yes,
know?
Yes.
But the thing is, it's such a good show. I mean, if you had a race where it was just those three guys out there and that's it, I'd watch it.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And then Bautista has been pretty good too. I mean, you got to remember
he's been doing real good
too. This is his first year in the 250s.
Right, exactly. But primarily for the top three guys, it's been Lorenzo Dovizioso and De Angelis. Yep. And that's how the championship is so far. And that's how the rates have been. But yes, you're right. Barbera is good. Although, just like Matthew Roberts said, actually, during the race, I think it was Matthew Roberts and Nick Harris. Somebody said it. When he first came up from 125s, I thought, this guy's going to be the star and this and that. And he really hasn't delivered. Thomas Luthi's always good. He's Julian Simon. There's a lot of guys that are the good racers in the 250s. And it's kind of cool to see them because it's they're younger and the teams are smaller, and I think there's more of almost a privateer-y sort of atmosphere.
Yes.
To at least the lesser teams. Yeah.
Even if they're quote unquote factory teams.
Right. Right. There are levels of factory. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Speaking of factory teams, KTM's not doing all that great this year.
No, so. I really thought that Hiro Ayama was going to be a big contender, and he's just doing terribly. I mean, he had a bad crash the first race, and I don't know if he hasn't recovered or he's just struggling in general.
Yeah, he's only finished two races in the points this year.
Yeah,
looking at the thing, yeah, and then Mika Kallio, an excellent rider, but and he's only finished three races in the points, and at Italy. there was the, I mean, and they got, you talk about the camera being in the right place at the right time. Lorenzo comes tearing around the corner, and Kallio had some kind of problem already, so he was slowing up. And it's not like Lorenzo intentionally ran into him or anything, but he basically sort of had nowhere to go, and he clips him, and,
oh,
and
yes,
his exhaust
that's right,
goes flying off. But, and the frustration on Mika Kallio was apparent. And oddly enough, what's the KTM guy's name? Bartels, whatever. Was laughing.
That's right.
For whatever reason it was, whether he was taken out by Lorenzo or because the bike crapped out or whatever. But, you know, the motorcycle just got broken out on the track. Your rider just trundled it off onto the gravel. He's pounding the tank in frustration and probably crying. And the team manager is laughing about it. I thought that was really bizarre. you know, so whatever. But, all right, well, we got
to
go.
Well, wait, we didn't get to the best part of it.
Wait, okay,
so
what's that?
We didn't get to the best part. The best part was what happened on the second to last lap. So
yes,
we've got Lorenzo leading the race, Bautista and De Angelis kind of looking almost like they're fighting it. It's almost, like, Bautista's going after Lorenzo, but De Angelis is, like, taking advantage every time he can to squeeze in between them.
Right.
Bautista looks like he gets really pissed, goes into the, I think De Angelis takes the lead. Bautista tries to also take Lorenzo and then does this, like, this is what I was talking about before we started recording, was that this is that incredible Spanish racing blood. These guys, like, are, even this close to the end, they're going to win it, you know? Bautista comes in really hot, goes all the way into the rumble strip, leaving Lorenzo nowhere to go. Lorenzo does not slow down, does not even touch the brakes, touches the back of Bautista's bike, goes off the track, falls down, of course.
He slid across the track.
Yeah. I mean, he has a moment to shake his fists at Bautista, gets the bike back up, and still manages to finish eighth. So
yes.
Unbelievable stuff. And, you know, there was a lot of talk about Bautista possibly getting penalized. I was reading somewhere that the FIM was looking it over, but apparently that's not going to happen. Apparently it was just considered to be...
FIM said it was a racing incident.
Yep.
So they said, forget it.
Yep.
Yeah. And actually, when I saw it and stuff, I mean, it was an extremely aggressive pass.
Yes.
And if I was anybody other than Makoto Tomata, I would think, you know, that's just it. It was a racing incident. If I was Makoto Tomata, I'd be pissed as hell because he got penalized for basically the same sort of thing at
back in 2003.
Yeah,
was it? Yeah.
Was it that long ago?
It was a long time ago. Yeah.
Yeah, and where he was penalized for what in effect was just a very aggressive pass, but not like, you know. I don't think it was, you know, dangerous, but I think they were also, in general, skittish. They didn't want people, you know, they'd had Cato dying 2 years previously. And to that, you know, whenever, how far exactly it was in months, you know, just in general, they were a bit more skittish. But whatever the official FIM ruling is that no, it's a racing incident. Too bad, so sad.
Yep.
Get over it.
Yep.
And Lorenzo was pissed off.
He was pissed.
And, Yeah, he slid across on his chest across the asphalt and kind of stopped right there on the edge of the track in the gravel, and his bike's, I don't know, probably 20 feet away. And he gets up, shakes his fist at Bautista, and then goes and gets the motorcycle.
Yeah, it's
so
great stuff. Great stuff. And then De Angelis was meanwhile leading, but Bautista did this beautiful dive last lap. Just a few corners from the end, and
one too. Yeah,
and won the race.
Yeah, takes his first victory. So good job to him.
By 8/10 of a second, or 8/100 of a second.
How far was it?
8/100 of a second.
Nine one hundredths. It was about a front wheel.
Yep.
Yeah, and and they were going on about it on the announcers, saying it was a 10th of a second. I was like, there's no way that could be as much of a 10th of a second.
Right.
It's almost a 10th. That's amazing, because it was only about a wheel length. You know, you're talking, What are they running to, 50, 17 inch wheels? And with the tire and all that, you know.
Well, they're a bit slower than the MotoGP bikes, but.
Oh yeah, but still. Yeah, you remember that finish they had a couple of years ago where it was not even the tire sidewall width?
That's right.
I mean.
Yeah. Good stuff.
Okay, whatever. Now this time we really do have to go.
Okay.
So it was great talking to you, Jules. It really was. We'll have to do it again.
Okay, man.
All right, we got Liam Schubert on the phone. Hi, Liam. How you doing?
Hey, hi, Bob. Great to hear your voice.
Nice to hear you, too. It's always good. I guess you're in Barcelona right now. You're what, in a restaurant, just finishing up dinner? Or?
No, actually, well, yes, I am in Barcelona. We're at a restaurant called Moncho's, quite close to my house, and the team is set to arrive in the next 5 or 10 minutes so that we can have a team dinner to, one, celebrate a little bit of the last race, and two, to get going for Catalunya, because for us that starts Wednesday morning just after 8 o'clock at the circuit.
Sure. And I mean, both of these races are sort of, I'll bet they're kind of critical for you, but I mean, Catalunya is pretty much your guys' home race, right? The team's home race, isn't it?
Well, for the most part, yes. It's closer to Catalunya from Madrid than it is to the other circuits in Spain. Also, a few of us from the team are based in Barcelona, and it being the home of Dorna, it just brings a huge contingent of Spaniards to the race. I mean, it's a big Danny Pedrosa race at this point.
yeah, that's true. But, well, I'm really glad you were able to take a little bit of time to talk with us here. You guys must be just amped about Barros's podium. So can you tell us a little bit about what was going through the garage and everybody's mind, you know, when you saw that pass that he made there?
Sure. Actually, I think this was maybe the most stressful weekend I've had yet racing, because this is the home of Ducati we were racing at, and all the Italian fans are so passionate. They come out in force for two things or three things. They come out for Rossi, they come out for the Italian riders, and they come out in droves for Ducati. And so many of the factory workers and factory personnel will come to this race. It was just amazing to see how many Ducati personnel were there, wandering through the paddock, and I was working closely with some of them in my truck, going over stock and a few other details. So there was a lot of pressure for Ducati as a brand to do well, and also a lot of pressure on Rossi, because he's only won one race out of the first five, and Stoner and his Ducati combination have been doing so well. Everyone thought that Mugello's Monster Straight was really going to lend a big advantage to the Ducatis, but as I predicted earlier in the season, the other brands were going to catch up and they were going to find ways around the speed deficit. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. And so I'm just going to say that, and that is what you think we're seeing here with the performance that we saw from Rossi and Pedrosa and all of that. That the Honda and the Yamaha are kind of they're playing catch up now.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Kawasaki has rocketed to the top or near the top of the speed charts. The Suzuki is also quite powerful, getting a good drive out of the corners. The Honda has found 800 more revs, allegedly, and Alex Barros told me after one of the sessions that next to the Ducatis that Pedrosa's Honda is the most powerful machine. It certainly looked like it in the race, and it seems like a lot of people are really finding a way around. Maybe they don't have ultimate top speed, but they're getting great drives out of the corners, and the stability under braking and in and through the turns is great, particularly with Rossi's bike. He makes it look so easy. It's like him and the machine are one. Beautiful to watch him ride at Mugello. Absolutely beautiful. As far as the setup for the weekend, Friday and Saturday brought mixed conditions, cold and damp in the morning sessions, but dry, and then in the afternoon torrential downpours struck, which really threw a monkey wrench as far as dry time to get the right setting and also to find what would be the best tire for the race. So even as the race was starting on Sunday, we'd had the half-wet, half-dry qualifying session where it was so wet initially, and then there was a dry section towards the middle, then a torrential downpour again, then it started to dry up towards the end. Even by 30 minutes into qualifying, when Stoner had set such a fast lap, I knew that was the pole time, because there was no way after the second downpour that anyone was going to come close to that. So in that respect, they got lucky, and they set some great qualifying times. We only managed 10th and 11th. I think we could have gone a little bit faster in the wet, but there was no sense for us to push it quite so hard in the wet qualifying condition, because we didn't know what Sunday was going to bring. And on the grid on Sunday, the skies were dark, clouds were rolling in, and I thought, geez, it might be another one of these NASCAR-type races where two-thirds of the way through the race, it just comes down. I was pretty nervous, actually, all weekend for that, more than anything. More than it being my anniversary race or Ducati's race, I kept thinking about the weather because that was the biggest factor of this weekend. And it was a real gamble and lottery choosing tires for the race. I think in our case, we chose a pretty well-rounded tire, and I think we would have gone faster if it had been a little cooler temperatures towards the end of the race. We thought that it would get colder and darker and wetter, but, you know, I don't know what kind of God there was, but he decided to bless Mugello with a beautiful race. I mean, the sun came out, the bikes were screaming, Rossi had a magical moment in racing history to secure his sixth win. And as expected, Pedrosa, based on his times the previous 2 days and during the warm-up, Pedrosa really put the hammer down and challenged him for quite a while. So I think for us, the best possible result was being third. I mean, but when we were in fifth, I knew Barros smelled blood in the water, and he went by Hopper and then continued on after Stoner. And you know, there's no team politics and no team orders, but I'm sure that was a pretty significant podium for us because it was in the home of Ducati and it was in front of the works team. And I don't know, it's shocking when I think about it. It's still, you know, it has sunk in somewhat, and I'm sure it'll sink in the future. But personally for me, I've got to shift gears tonight and get into the next race because I can't afford to keep dwelling on one podium. It's time to work towards Catalunya's race.
Right. You can't just sort of sit back and rest on your laurels, so to speak.
There's been no major parties, no monstrous celebration like I'd want to because I can't afford to sleep in and be hungover.
Wow.
I spent all day sorting through files and emailing today to the factory, and I'm hoping we clean up a couple things before the next race because we want to do really well in Catalunya, and so does the factory.
Right. So save the big celebrations for after Catalunya when you get a little bit more of a break, a little bit?
Yeah, I think so. Plus, you know, there's 12 races left, and that's 36 podiums. And ideally, I can get 12 of them. But that's wishful thinking because the field is so deep, and every manufacturer is challenging now. I think the biggest indication of how exciting this series is at this point is looking at the grid positions from this last race. You had a Ducati, a Suzuki, and a Yamaha on the front row. Then you've got Hondas, Kawasaki's. Everybody is in the mix, and everybody's really showing that they're coming to terms with the 800s. The tires are all working really well, whether it's a Bridgestone or a Michelin. One thing that struck me about this race is it's obvious Michelin is really putting a lot of effort into making tires for Rossi and Pedrosa because they were head and tails, head and shoulders above everyone else that was riding Michelin in this race. If you look at the screenshot afterwards, it's Rossi, Pedrosa on Michelin's, and then the next seven were on Bridgestones. So, but that's a pretty significant indication of who's getting what at this point.
Yeah, I agree. And that's actually one thing that I hadn't considered much in some of my other chatting with the race with some people. One thing about tires, while we're talking about tires, I know the rules are different in the wet. Now, how does it work? I mean, is it now all of a sudden, if it's a wet weekend, do you have an unlimited supply of tires again?
Yes.
Okay.
However, in a race condition, if it's a wet race and you start off on slicks, you can come in and change for wet, so you can switch to your second bike. However, if you choose the wrong wet tire, you cannot come in and change to another wet. You have to come in and change to an intermediate or a slick. Fortunately, we haven't had any of those crazy conditions where we need to switch more than once, because then you're looking at losing, you know, a minute and a half, which is unacceptable in a race where split seconds come down. One thing about predicting the weather. After the race, I don't know how many people watched it, but you saw how many thousands of people swamped the area and swarmed over the track. You know, this is something that's happened in previous years at different races, whether it's in Italy or France or wherever. And, you know, I've mentioned before publicly that if things aren't bolted down, they'll get stolen. And even if they are bolted down, they'll get stolen. And we lost a very expensive weather station at this race. We managed to bring in our television sets, our monitors from our canopy box, and bring our chairs in from the box and whatever we could from outside. We closed the garage doors with frosted over windows. And you needed to be on a ladder or something significantly high in order to get up to our weather station, and they still managed to get it. So we're going to be weather stationless in Catalonia unless we can work fast.
Yeah, that sucks.
This is something that happened to Burgess, who I flew in with from Bologna on Monday. So I had a great talk with him, and fascinating person. I really hope to be able to spend some more time with him in the future.
Yeah,
anyway, we lost our weather station, and now we go to Barcelona relying on the internet instead of our on-site machine.
That's terrible. I hope you guys get that sorted out, because that's ridiculous. One thing to steal a sign, it's kind of a souvenir of a race. I can sort of see that, but
right, it's absolutely useless without the software that we've got to run it. So for somebody, it's just going to be like putting a satellite or a spaceship hanging from the ceiling in their living room, like, check out what I got.
Yeah, it's just stupid.
Pretty wild.
Well, all right. We probably better let you go. I know you're super busy. I do appreciate the time that you took here to talk to us. We love having you on the show, Liam. And how about a call next week? And, man, maybe you'll get a little more time, and we can talk for a little longer, and we'll just go on about both races.
Perfect. I'd really, really like to get into that. I think maybe our position in Mugello will finally have sunk in, and I hope to be able to say a little bit about a great position in Mugello. I mean in Catalonia. Tough to shift gears.
Yes.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to MotoGPOD. This is Moto Liam signing out.
Thank you, Liam. Okay, hi, Chuck. How are you doing today?
I'm not doing too bad, Bob. Yourself?
No, I'm doing fine. Thanks very much. It's good to be back and enjoying MotoGP. So thank you very much for taking some time here on the phone with us and do a little bit of talking about Team KR and your progress so far this season. Overall, how was Mugello? I mean, you had Curtis there and Kenny. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it was, to try and do something that we're doing, having two riders is pretty much essential, just especially when you start to, ask questions that there don't seem to be answers for. And having Curtis there was good because, he knows how to ride a motorcycle. He has good feedback. The team's worked with him before, and pretty much he was backing up, a lot of the areas where, Kenny's been struggling. So, just having that more or less confirmation provided, our team and our engineers some good feedback. And, going into Mugello, I'd have to say there were a lot of questions with not a lot of answers. And I think coming out, at least we could see light. And, that's all we can work for. We think we have some direction. It's going to entail, pretty much a complete revision of the bike, but that's racing. That's our game.
So you are looking at a complete revision now, then, is what you're thinking?
Yeah, pretty much so. There are some areas that, our engineers kind of, work through and we feel some changes need to be made to the chassis that will help improve the bike. I don't think our bike is so far different than, the other satellite team bikes, but, we think we have some ideas that could improve that. And, racing at the bottom is not what we're about. We don't like being there, don't want to be there. But, you also have to keep in mind that, probably Honda have been working, on this bike for, nearly a year. And, they're still making chassis for the works team and changing things and so forth. So we're really taking our second step at it. And it took about this time last year with many different changes with the 990 before we started to hit stride. And hopefully with these changes we have in store, it won't be the next race or the race after because it's quite an involved process, but hopefully mid-season or around Laguna, just after the break, we'll start to hit stride again.
And now on that, when you said Honda has been working on their chassis for a year and all that, when did you sort of get your first 800cc engines, and when were you able to really start serious testing?
Well, we got the drawings of it at the Portugal Grand Prix. Well, you know, obviously Junior nearly won the race. He's on the podium, and you know, there we received what the layout of the engine was going to be. Took the data back to our engineers. I think that was, you know, sometime mid September, beginning of September, and you know, during from September to you know, basically the first bike I think was finished January 10th, and when we're talking a new bike, it was obviously a complete redesign because of the engine. So we did new body work, new chassis, airbox, wiring harness, the whole lot basically. And you know, I had to go to Japan because our bike, you know, our intake system is different than the HRC bikes, and you know, basically Honda required us to send our bike to them just for dyno testing, just to make sure that everything's okay, you know, with the intake side and that the, you know, running of the bike's okay. Our exhaust system is different than theirs, so there are some things that are different that they need to check out. But, you know, you're talking September, October, November, December, and beginning first week of January it was sent away. And I think the first time that bike was back in our workshop was, you know, before we headed off to Italy.
Wow, so... they had it for a little while there, and
well, it went there for a dyno check, and then from there it went to the first test in Malaysia. And since then, you know, all our equipment has been gone, basically, you know, just following the circuit, which is kind of a bummer for our design office because they, you know, bust their butts over the winter, and our fabricators, machinists, you know, working hard during Christmas, and then as soon as the first bike is built up and done, and you know, they see it for about 20 minutes and then it's put in the box and sent away. it's unfortunate for them.
Yeah, that it almost sounds though that almost nothing on this motorcycle that you're running now comes from last year's bike, or is that true? I mean, were you able to use I know obviously you're going to use a lot of the knowledge, but were you able to use much of the actual motorcycle itself from last year?
Not really. Not much of it, actually. I think the, you know, things like the swing arm are quite similar, and we were able to take, you know, the swing arms across with some modifications. But no, it was basically a complete new motorcycle.
Okay, radically different. As a team manager, are you facing right now with the performance that you guys are doing? Are you having sort of morale issues within the team, and how are you handling that?
Well, it's nothing that we haven't been through before, but it is very difficult, and you know, you sort of just have to grin and bear it, to be honest. You know, at least we're on to something that we think is a direction forward. And normally when we figure out something like this, it generally improves the bike. So it's frustrating because, you know, the R800 this year has showed signs of a good machine. And during the preseason testing, you know, I'd have to say on race tires, we're probably always, you know, probably from 5 to, you know, 10 quickest, you know, generally on race tires. So it's not like we were last all through testing. But when we come to the races, and there's a few other variables involved too. The new tire rule hasn't really helped us. And, you know, when you're racing with somebody rather than testing, and you know, I think it's no secret that Honda have lacked a little bit of performance on the motor. So you have all these things that really, you know, sooner or later they're going to sort of demotivate the rider. And I think that's one of the areas we're kind of going through now. But like I said, I have to be an optimist. And sure, it's nobody in our team or organization wants to be where we're at. But like I said, you know, a lot of guys had a big head start. The other satellite Honda teams at least have a basis of comparison where our bike is different than theirs. You know, we have the same motor, and in some cases the same tires, but, you know, they have, you know, the same bikes that they could at least, you know, go to for references with each other. The tire thing, you know, the new tire rule, we've had instances too where, you know, we've had a selection of tires and very few of them have worked. And, you know, in Turkey, a lot of people don't know that we actually had a tire problem in the race. And, you know, Valentino did as well, and it was a similar problem to his, but our bike was affected straight off. So it's, you know, there's a number of variables involved as usual, but, you know, we just got to regroup and fight back, and that's hopefully what we're doing now.
Now, having Curtis there at Mugello, did that sort of, did you see it, kind of an increase in enthusiasm and all that? I mean, I know you learned a lot from it, but did it sort of lend a new atmosphere to the garage and the pits?
Well, it's good having two riders. The difficult part was we're running two riders with one bike each. You know, we're running two riders with on a sort of one engine program right now. So come Sunday, there was a little bit of worry that, well, what happens if it does rain halfway through the race? If it did, our only choice was to change wheels, you know, which would take a little bit of time. But I don't know about raising spirits or any of that. Basically, it like I said, it helped confirm some areas and probably, if anything, gave Kenny Jr. a little bit more peace of mind because, you know, he's been saying these things are happening and really there's not another guy on the other side of the garage saying these things are happening. So, you know, and then when the engineers go look on the data and they can't really pinpoint these areas that are a problem, it starts to lead doubt everywhere. But, you know, in the team we know if Kenny has the right equipment, you know, you just don't go from, you know, being on the podium last year. Coming into the season, he thought that we would had a chance to do better than we did last year. And when that didn't, you know, started to not be reality, then, you know, just it gets more difficult. So, you know, where the enthusiasm will come from is, like I said, at least we left Mugello with a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel. And now we look forward to, you know, when our guys get the new version done to test that. And hopefully that's going to bring us back. Saying that, there's no guarantees.
Sure.
Unfortunately.
Curtis is still on for Catalunya, correct?
That's right, yeah.
And then you've got Jonathan Ray at Donington, the following race.
Well, that's right, yeah.
Then you've got Aston and Deutschland. Is anything on the, Saxon Ring?
Well, yeah, well, we actually haven't thought that far in advance yet. I mean, Jonathan Ray is, you know, probably not a lot of Americans know who he is, but he's the second rider on the factory Honda team here in Britain, participates in the British Superbike Championship. He's 20 years old. He's probably one of the, you know, up-and-coming, you know, best up-and-coming young British riders in quite a while. I think he lies third or fourth right now in the British Championship, and it's his second season. Very good rider. He's actually in Japan right now practicing for the Suzuki 8-hour, and this weekend he's got to participate in sort of the warm-up race of that, which is a 300-kilometer race. He runs Michelin tires, so, you know, that kind of smoothed the way for Michelin. And, you know, we have some UK sponsors, UK-based sponsors, motorpoint.co.uk, which, you know, their market is just here in England. You know, we felt putting a British rider on, especially one of Jonathan's caliber and his age, not only would it bring some extra benefit for the sponsors here in the UK, but also give him at 20 years old a taste of, you know, what Grand Prix are. And, you know, he knows Donington quite well, and, you know, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, sure. No, I think it's great, and it's good to see you. You know, being an American team, but you are based in England, and you know, you have these things to think about.
Yeah.
Now, on to other things that Team KR is doing. I remember reading somewhere that Tencati was using the Team KR swing arms on their bikes in World Superbikes. Is that so? And are they having good luck with those?
Well, I mean, the project started a little bit last year with Alex Barros, and we built some swing arms for him and actually American Honda and racing team here in the UK, Paul Bird, Stobart Racing. And, you know, we're basically using some of the MotoGP technology with the linkages and swing arms and applying it to the CBR 1000. And this year, yeah, James Toseland and his teammate Rolfo are using equipment. There's a second team, Alto Evolution, and of course, Stobart's using them again here in the British Championship, as well as American Honda with Miguel and Jake Zemski in the States. So it's an area that, you know, it's quite specialized for us. You know, we're starting to get more involved in that end. You know, we have the staff here in the UK to design components and you know, work with various teams to improve their machines, so why not, basically.
And that does also somewhat tie in with, I've seen some rumors running around about Team KR going to World Superbike next year or sometime in the future. Is anything to that, or is that just wild rumor?
Well, a lot of, you know, you can never say never, to be honest, with where you're going. Right now we're focused on MotoGP, and I think a lot of that speculation stemmed from the Silverstone World Superbike race is, you know, it's about 10 minutes from my workshop and 20 minutes from my house, and I took young Stevie Bonzi, the young American 125 rider that we're helping out, took him over for a day at Silverstone. And at the same time, basically, you know, went around to see our clients, Alpha Evolution people, and talked to a few other teams that are interested in, you know, support from us and products for the future. So it's kind of a, you know, more a visit for commercial reasons. And I took the opportunity to meet with Paolo Ciabatti, who I'd never met before. And, you know, just got some idea from him of what, you know, where World Superbike was going, components, you know, like we're already selling there, are still going to have a place and so forth. So it wasn't there to really go find out what's involved with starting a team. It was more to you know, go support the people we're already helping out. So, a little spark kind of created the fire, but, you know, I was there for one day, and it was really nothing more than that. Although, you know, who knows what the future could hold. That's why I'd say you could never say never about something like that. It's the same, you know, eventually we'd like to be involved in American Superbike racing and so forth. But, yeah, I mean, right now our place is MotoGP, and you know, we had a great year last year, and already we started out worse than we anticipated, and we just need to fight back. We have, you know, more sponsor interest in the team. You know, hopefully we could create that in something positive for the forthcoming years.
Okay, excellent. What happened to Curtis and Mugello with the retirement? I haven't been able to find a lot of news about that.
Well, basically, we were, you know, both Kenny and Curtis were struggling. We used probably that race more of a test session than anything. And, you know, we just gambled on a setup to see if we can get the thing working properly and told Curtis that, look, if it doesn't work right, then, you know, no need to really go on. And basically, the gamble didn't pay off. So, you know, better come in than just go out there and, you know, wobble around. So there was no engine problem or nothing, you know, nothing drastic. It was just, you know, it's a gamble. It didn't work, basically.
All right. Yeah, it's completely understandable and no sense in risking the rider, you know, or the machine
exactly.
Out there. Yeah. All right. Well, again, thank you very much for taking the time on the phone with us. We wish you the best of luck over there in Spain and all the future races, and hope to be able to maybe drop by and say hello in person when you guys come to Laguna Seca.
Yeah, sounds good. No problem, Bob.
All righty. Thank you very much, Chuck.
All right. Take care.
All right. Again, I want to say a big thank you to Liam Schubert and Chuck Axlin and Jules Cisick for all your help and taking the time to talk with me about MotoGP. Without you guys, MotoGP OD would not be possible, and it would be much, much less of a show with me just sitting here talking to myself in a lonely room. So thank you very much for tuning in, and I do appreciate it. If you would like to listen to the chat that Jules and I had about the qualification session for MotoGP, I put that up there on the website at MotoGPOD.com. You'll find it in the little show notes that are right under the current episode. It'll be, you know, the QualiCast outtake kind of a thing. You know, it's about 15 minutes long, and it was kind of fun. It's just we ran about an hour and a half already, and it was getting ridiculous, so I had to cut it out. But otherwise than that, I hope you enjoyed the show a lot. Thank you very much for downloading it, and have a good time watching the Catalunya race that's coming up this next Sunday, and we're going to have a race wrap-up for that next week. And until I talk to you later, have a good time out there, stay safe, and keep the rubber side down. Welcome to the O2 messaging service. The person you are calling is unable to take your call. but they would very much like you to know that MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL, and the MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL, mainly because it is a loser fanboy hacker website run by a big weenie. All other trademarks are the property of the respective owners, and MotoGPOD is not affiliated with any of them.